This Israel report is brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands. Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you are based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.
It is 7:45. I'm Howard Feldman. This is your Morning Mayhem 101.9 Chai FM. Joining us this morning for the Israel Report is Kanan Lidor. He is a journalist for JNS and a correspondent for Chai FM. Kanan Lidor, a very good morning. I'm hoping you're well.
Good morning. Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Great pleasure. So yesterday, 1,000 days since October the 7th. What did this look like across Israel?
Across Israel, it was rather unmarked. It wasn't an official day of commemoration. We have several of them. We have the Hebrew day, and we have an alternative one, and we have a government one. But so on the official level, this was just noted by the foreign ministry, by even Mike Huckabee, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, noting in statements, maybe a press conference the IDF also held to kind of take stock of what has happened since October 7. Where are we now militarily? The IDF overviewed, but the real action happened actually last night in Tel Aviv, where a few thousand people gathered at Hostages Square in the center of Tel Aviv for what they billed as a commemoration event, but really it was an anti-government event with speakers like Einav Zangaukir, whose son Matan was taken hostage and released, with Eyal Eshel, whose son died in the massacre of October 7th. And they came up to the stage, and one by one they delivered speeches very critical of Netanyahu. Mm-hmm. One of them, Einav Zangaukir, as I mentioned, said there are 1,000 days passed and there are more than 1,000 bodies in the ground, and that's on you, Benjamin Netanyahu. And of course, you know, this is an election year, and Netanyahu and the government cannot ignore October 7 and the horrors that happened there. But their take is, look, we got all the hostages dead and alive back, which is something that no one imagined would happen. Israel is in a much stronger place geopolitically right now. Hezbollah is cowering in southern Lebanon, despite their limitations, despite the limitations on use of force, which they don't admit. But despite that, just yesterday, a Hezbollah terrorist was killed. The whole Middle East has changed, and that's the legacy of October 7. So that's the debate that we're having. And as part of that, we're also debating what kind of commission of inquiry we'll have after October 7, now that the war seems to have really quieted down, the war that kind of was triggered by October 7 and escalated from there to a huge regional war, of course. So now is the time to really look back and do an official committee of inquiry. And there's a debate about whether this is going to be a state-appointed one, a judicially appointed one. That's where we're at.
Is the fact that there hasn't been an independent commission of inquiry, has that maybe impacted how this is recognized and commemorated, or is that just a place to put people's anger and frustration?
It's definitely impacted. Why isn't there a committee of inquiry? Yes, it's because of the government that doesn't want a judicially appointed committee that's going to put all the blame on the government. But it's also because of the establishment that opposes Netanyahu, the military establishment. Every country's got them. Some call them deep states. That also is very apprehensive about a government-appointed committee, because that's going to look at the military failures. So you have a paralysis, you have an impasse because of the disputed balance of power in Israel over this, and that's on the political level, but you know, on the emotional level, on the emotional of the victims, and almost everyone in Israel was in some way a victim, there is a feeling of shirking of responsibility, be it by the government, be it by the establishment, and we're not getting over this. We're not going through this. There's no resolution. We are stuck in limbo after October 7th, and in that regard, it was a great success for Hamas.
It's really, really quite frightening. And I wanted to ask you about African visitors brave the war to study Israel's innovation.
Yes, it's amazing that this stuff is still happening. Israel is so attractive. It's such a shiny gem that even as Iran was preparing to fire rockets, dozens, maybe, and overall hundreds of visitors from really the global south are still packing their bags and coming to Israel. And I got to speaking to a delegation from Africa. There was even a representative from South Africa. You won't fault me for not being able to pronounce his last name, but it was Lita. Right. And he comes from the royal family of the Eastern Cape region, one of them. And it was just amazing to see how they took that risk. And on the first day that they arrived, 20 people from across Africa, there was actually a launch from Iran. They were ushered into the shelter of the Mashal Haifa Center, the training center of the foreign ministry. And then they just went on with the program as if it was nothing. And it made me wonder whether maybe this, the life in South Africa, life in Africa in general, shares a lot of the uncertainty that we have here, a lot of the improv, a lot of the, Africa time, Israel time, the delays, the unexpected nature of life. I wonder if that prepared them.
Pretty sure that it did. That is so funny. And what is it that they are studying there?
Well, they are one group that's looking at innovation, but Mashav is bringing hundreds of people to look at agriculture, which also has innovation aspects, of course, and education, women's rights. So this group, this was a slightly higher profile group of professionals in their 30s and 40s, and they were looking at innovation. So they went to places like Checkpoint, the cybersecurity giant. They went to the Center of Blue Economy, where they use the ocean sustainably, and they toured the Paris Center for Innovation, all the highlights that Israel has to offer. And of course, as anyone would, their minds got blown by the plethora of innovation and entrepreneurship that is on display here. But what's interesting is that in my talks with these people, what kept surfacing is not the gadgets and the, oh, look at this cool thing. It's the mentality. One participant described it as a Yala mentality, which means, Yala means let's go in Arabic, and means let's get this done. Another from Ethiopia noticed how there's no hierarchy here. So high-tech manager, the head of the startup,
This low
will
power
sit with
base.
The most junior employee.
And it's so funny because I've done so much research on this, and what they find is the lower the power distance, the greater the innovation. So in a country, for example, like Russia, where you've got a very, very, very big distance, I think that it's like a 15, or I can't remember how they calibrate the numbers, there's much less innovation because people have to be much more respectful to somebody else. But the lower the power distance, the greater innovation, because everybody has something to contribute, which is so fascinating.
And that takes us back to our first item on the show, you know, with Einav Zangaukr, the mother of the hostage, who gets up and shouts all kinds of foul things at the prime minister. And, and then we shake our heads and we say, oh, this is terrible. This is signs of disintegration, disunity. But it's also the source of power that drives this locomotive forward.
It's absolutely fascinating. Moving away from issues within Israel, but ones that impact greatly is let's just talk about Trump, Iran, where we are, and the fact that Trump is questioning how Jews support the Democrats. But let's start with just an understanding of where this agreement is at.
Well, right now we're seeing talk of another extension of the negotiations until July 18. One problem that arose is the American insistence that the Iranians clear the mines that they threw into the Strait of Hormuz. And that's phrased in general terms. It's phrased to guarantee the safety of vessels passing through the Hormuz in the framework of the agreement. Problem is, the Iranians themselves, it seems, don't know where the mines are. Those are mines that were dropped from fishing boats to evade U.S. satellite surveillance and during wartime. And so they feel like that's the interpretation, that they can't guarantee the safe passage, because if one of those mines does explode, then they can't be held accountable for it from their perspective. And that kind of exposes an element of the Iranian way of waging warfare. Chaos is not something that is limited by tarnished. The implied message here is we're not even in control of what we're doing. So if you get rid of us, who knows what will happen? Don't mess with us. If you push us, you'll only get more instability. So that's where things are stuck right now. The American want assurances that the Strait of Hormuz will remain open, and the Iranians, amazingly, are trying to shirk responsibility for that. Now, Trump has given them, I believe, 2 more weeks past the announced, I don't know if it was agreed upon, but announced deadline of the last round. But we're also seeing American forces, heavy bombers, leaving the Middle East, indicating a winding down of the conflict, no matter what comes of the negotiations. When you see the military movement on the ground, then that means the show is over.
Yeah, and what does that mean for Israel? I mean, there was talk that this week I saw reports or comments on social media, Israel might have to continue this or go alone. Is there any realistic expectation that that might be the case?
With Iran, there is a general understanding that it's over. The big question, of course, is Hezbollah. Uh-huh. Does the agreement with Iran also spill over to Hezbollah, as Iran claims, wants, pushes? Or is Israel free to manage this Iranian proxy, this threat on its northern border? Right now, there's no definite answer. As we mentioned, we just saw yesterday the idea of strike and kill a Hezbollah terrorist. But that said, it's very unlikely that we'll see the kind of strikes in Beirut that really keep Hezbollah on their toes. So we're sliding into a war of attrition, a war of erosion in Lebanon, with one very important difference, of course, which is the agreement that was signed on June 26 between Lebanon and Israel over Hezbollah's head, over Iran's head, saying that the IDF will stay in southern Lebanon, that's the Lebanese government saying, until Hezbollah is removed, until the Lebanese army is ready to take up the vacuum. That is unprecedented. And that is a geopolitical feat for Israel. Now, we have signed agreements with Lebanon before we even had a peace agreement with Lebanon in the 1980s. It crashed, and Lebanon crashed into civil war. So, you know, let's take it with a pinch of salt, but still, that's where things are.
That is where we do need to leave it. Kanani Dora, thank you. As always, wishing you a fantastic weekend, a Shabbat Shalom. It is 8 o'clock. We'll be back just after this.
That Israel Report was brought to you by the Blue Agency. Your Israel property is in good hands. Owning properties in Israel can be a great investment, but challenging to manage if you are based abroad. The Blue Agency will manage every aspect of your property, finding and vetting tenants, maintaining your property and getting it rental ready, negotiating contracts and collecting rentals, reporting back to you regularly. The Blue Agency has built a reputation for trust and confidentiality over 20 years. The Blue Agency, your Israel property is in good hands. Contact us at www.theblueagency.com.